Lecture 22, The State and the Working Class. So here's the basic puzzle. I think in the syllabus I quote these two contrasting quotes, one from Marx and one from Lenin, about the democratic state in capitalism. Since I so rarely quote from the founders of the Marxian tradition, let me just repeat what was there. So Marx writes in his essay, The Class Struggles in France, "The comprehensive contradiction of this constitution, however, consists in the following. The classes whose social slavery the constitution is to perpetuate, proletariat, peasantry, petty bourgeoisie, it puts into the possession of political power through the universal suffrage. And from the class whose old social power it sanctions, the bourgeoisie, it withdraws the political guarantees of this power. It forces the political rule of the bourgeoisie into democratic conditions, which at every moment help the hostile classes to victory and jeopardize the very foundations of bourgeois society." That's a pretty straightforward statement. You know, it's hard for me to see how you can parse that statement to say the democratic form is the best form for the perpetuation of capitalist rule. You know, he says, it forces political rule of the bourgeoisie into democratic conditions which at every moment help the hostile classes to victory and jeopardize the very foundations of bourgeois society. That's a statement that the democratic form in the capitalist state is deeply contradictory. 60 years later, in The State and Revolution, Lenin writes that parliamentary democracy is the best possible shell, that's his famous phrase, for the perpetuation of bourgeois rule. Right, so those aren't the same diagnosis. You know, there are mental gymnastics by which you can somehow or other dialectically, convolutedly make these the same, but I think these are directly opposed views as to what bourgeois democracy entails. On the one hand, a view that it is deeply contradictory, on the other hand, that it's the best possible shell. Now, in fact, in spite of my glib statement that these are incompatible, one, if you take this view about contradictory functionality, one could make the argument that, yes, these are deeply contradictory, but it still is the best you can get. It could be that a deeply contradictory political form is the best political form available, that all others are even more contradictory. So that under developed capitalist conditions, a purely authoritarian, undemocratic form of rule is even worse for the perpetuation of bourgeois rule in the long run, because it is incapable of solving the pragmatic problems that capitalism faces. So it could be that contradictory functionality is the best you can get. That's how I would bring these two statements together, even though that's not, in fact, what the two theorists were talking about. Lenin was not saying this is a deeply contradictory form that empowers workers, yet it's the best possible shell we can have. What he was saying is it's all completely phony, that none of the democracy amounts to anything, that it doesn't empower the hostile classes to accomplish anything, and we should just ignore it. Well, not ignore it, because you have to deal with it, but it's not a viable avenue. And Marx was, in fact, saying, in those capitalist states that have this bourgeois democratic form, that should be the arena of struggle, and you should take it seriously, because it is an avenue for empowerment. All right, so that's the kind of starting point. How do we then understand the way democracy functions? And there is this kind of puzzle. The puzzle that Marx poses, I think, is a real one. It's a political form which does create avenues for the hostile classes of capitalism, those classes who are harmed by the perpetuation of capitalism. It does give actors vehicles for contesting for state power. And it removes from the capitalist class the privileged access to those levers of power. And yet what we observe empirically is that these are incredibly stable systems once they're built up. And certainly once they become reasonably prosperous. That is, once the, I think Adam Shavorsky has a paper where he looks at the stability of capitalist democracies as a function of the per capita income of people in a capitalist democracy. And in, I think it was $1990, whenever he wrote the paper, there has never been a case of a overthrow of a democratic capitalist system if the per capita income was above $6,000 in $1990 or whatever year it was. So there's 100% stability of those systems. That is stability in the double sense that the regime has remained democratic in its form and it's remained capitalist in 100% of the cases. So that's that is a puzzle in the context of a theory which sees capitalism as so damaging to the possibilities and that the potential for human flourishing of transcending capitalism is as great as Marxists claim and as I would claim. Why are these systems so stable? I think that Adam Shavorsky's work on this, while there are certainly lots of places, lots of aspects of it that we can criticize, I think his general approach to this problem is extremely useful. And that's why I've featured his arguments for this particular topic. What I'd like to do is first present in a general abstract way what I think of as the underlying general model that he uses for how we should think about electoral democracy, and then discuss his very specific example of the dynamics of social democracy, of that is of the question, why do political working class political parties that have social democracy or socialism as their formal ideology, how do they relate to democratic institutions, and why is it that their participation helps to stabilize capitalism rather than disrupt it? But that particular argument operates against the backdrop of a more abstract theory or abstract model, which I've laid out diagrammatically in the outline. Shavorsky doesn't lay it out this way, but this is, I think, a correct representation of the core elements of his argument. The key here, and this is important for all of you political sociologists, this is, I think, a really important idea that has big ramifications in political sociology. The key idea is that what we need is a theory of voting rather than of voters. Most political sociology and political science, when they study elections, begin with an account of the attributes of voters. And the basic question they ask is, what determines why individuals vote the way they do? And the basic answer is sought by looking at various attributes of persons, their income, their education, their ethnicity, their gender, their religion, the region of the country they live in, all of these individual attributes, and trying to predict their voting behavior. So individual voting behavior is explained by individual voting attributes. That's the individualistic model of voting, and that's the dominant model that you'll find in both political sociology and political science. When you are during the election season and you look at polls, and then you look at the more sophisticated polls that actually break them down, what you see is the polls break down expected votes by the attributes of the voters. This big discussion in recent years of the gender gap in voting, women vote more democratic than men, asks the question, why is it that persons with this particular attribute, gender, vote in different ways? What Shavorsky says is that that is an extremely partial and incomplete view and deeply misleading because it takes as given the choices that voters face. and asks, given these choices, which come from somewhere, these attributes map onto behavior in this way. Whereas what Jaworski says is what we really need is a account of voting that begins with an account of the strategies of political parties. Because it's the strategies of parties that shape what the alternatives are and which define the terrain on which individuals, most of whom are not participants in the formation of those strategies. Right? So you'd see if it was the case that there was mass involvement in the formation of the strategies of party, then the distinction between the strategies of parties and the attributes of individuals, these two things, then becomes less meaningful because the attributes of individuals might explain why they're engaged in these strategies. But the process by which strategies of parties are determined are very different from the process by which individuals make their individual choices in the voting box. And that's why you get these two different levels of analysis. So for Jaworski, the key thing to figure out is the strategies of parties. Strategies of parties matter for all sorts of reasons. They matter in the simplest way because they actually determine what the electoral options are, who the candidates are, and what political ideologies they represent. But the strategies of party also matter because they affect the way individuals come to perceive those choices. Thus, in this little picture, the strategies of political parties affect the relationship between individual attributes and voting. I use the term mediates to describe that kind of causal relation, where one process affects the causal connection of two other. So you have the independent variable affecting the dependent variable, the independent attributes affect voting, but that very relation is itself affected by the strategies of parties. So then the question is, where do the strategies of parties come from? Right? Now, one thing that affects the strategies of parties is indeed voting patterns. Right? So parties adopt a strategy, they see what the outcome of elections are, they change their strategy. So one aspect of party strategy is this feedback process. The voting patterns select particular strategy. Selection just means it's a pressure on the partist, on this party within the range of strategies it could adopt that shapes which strategies they do adopt. But Jaworski's big contribution, I think, is in deeply trying to really sort out another effect on strategies, which is how the overall class structure imposes limits on the strategies. So the class structure is a macro property of a system. No individual has a class structure. Polities have a class structure. The class structure imposes limits on possible strategies of parties. The parties adopt a specific strategy within those limits. That particular strategy mediates the relationship of individual attributes to the actual voting outcomes, and those outcomes then select the strategies that has put pressures on the parties within the limits inscribed by class structure. So this then is the kind of Jaworskian model for how the different components fit together. The central problem then he sets once he establishes this broad model is, how do we explain the strategies of working class parties? How should we think about socialist parties? We can use a variety of terms, working class party, socialist party, social democratic party. You know, these labels have ambiguities to them. The meaning of what it is to call yourself a socialist party changes over time. You know, the Greek party just, and the Spanish parties, which just lost elections, were both called socialist parties, and they both imposed very severe austerity measures on their working classes. Does that mean that they are really capitalist parties, or is it just socialist parties under such horrendous constraints that they really had no choice as to what they did? Well, this is a debate, but clearly the meaning of what it is to be a socialist party does change over time. When Jaworski uses the word, he is meaning to imply that this is a party that really is committed in its ideology, in its self-understanding of what the point of its struggling for power is. It's really committed to transcending capitalism in a way that empowers the working class. So he is taking it as an assumption of his models, that is the way he's going to approach the problem, that these are parties that are committed to the socialist project in some meaningful way. Let me step back from the specifics before I give you the specifics and just make a comment on the status of models here. This is a constant source of confusion for people. This is something which I think almost any sociologist in the course of their learning the craft of sociology at some point stumbles on this question. What it means to make an assumption in a model relative to make a description about the world. So is it a good or a bad idea to say, let's for the purposes of this model assume that these parties really are socialist? And is it an appropriate criticism of the model to say, no, these parties never, this isn't a socialist party, it just uses the word. It's really just a bourgeois party that calls itself socialist. Is that a criticism of the model? What's the point of the model? This is similar to, if you recall, the earlier discussion we had of the transition trough, right? So that when Czaworski says about the transition trough, let us assume there's no counter-revolution by the capitalist class, that it doesn't mobilize a military coup in the face of a socialist party trying to enact socialism. Let's assume that there's no military coup. Now, is it an appropriate criticism of that model to say, but of course there would be a military coup, so why bother with this model? Okay, so this is the thing to remember. It's not a relevant criticism, I think. My view would be, it is not a relevant criticism of the model to say, but of course there would be a military coup. Now, if you know for sure there's going to be a military coup, then you know for sure in advance there's no point in ever a socialist party ever trying to be elected, because there would be a military coup. Right? So you've already solved the problem if you know for sure there's a military coup. You've already answered the question, is there a democratic route to socialism? The answer is no, because there'd be a military coup. What Czaworski is saying is, well, let's just assume there wouldn't be a military coup, so let's really imagine the most favorable environment for a transition to socialism, the most optimistic environment we could have, one in which you know for sure there won't be a military coup. So you get in power, you've got your time in office to do what you want. And let's assume that when you get into power, you really have a supermajority and you can really do what you want, right? So it's not just that you have to broker deals with minority parties that don't agree with you. Let's assume that all the favorable conditions that you could imagine. But let's allow the capitalist economy to be a regular capitalist economy, where there still is private ownership of the means of production and people control investments. And you have complicated supply chains with interdependent banks and all this stuff that makes a capitalist economy work. And now you get elected to power. You don't have to worry about a coup. You got a supermajority. What happens? Now, the purpose of that exercise is to really clarify the force of the distinctively capitalist accumulation mechanisms that would make it really hard to actually enact a socialist transition, even under the most favorable conditions, because of the transition trough problem. That the attempt at doing that would produce such a disruption of the ordinary functioning of the capitalist economy that standards of living would decline. In the context of their decline, anti-socialist parties would have a lot of credibility. Ha-ha, see, just like we said, they can't manage the economy. People might put up with that for a while. They might be patient. How patient? 20 years? 2 years? Well, that then determines, and how deep is the decline, and how quick is the recovery? All of that then determines whether that transition trough can be sustained in a democratic way. Because if it's in a democratic way, there's going to be competitors who are going to do all the stuff that competitors do. All right, so I think that that is clarified by making these radical simplifying assumptions. There's no coup, and you've got a big majority. And that's the case even if in the world we know there's always going to be some probability of a coup, and usually you're not going to have such favorable conditions. All of those make it even less plausible that there'd be a democratic transition from capitalism to socialism. Well, I think the same thing is operating here. Szymborski is saying, let's imagine good faith actors. So it's true, in the world you may have, hypocritical actors who really don't care at all about the socialist project, but see an opportunistic way of gaining political power by using these labels. He says, let's just assume that that's not the case. Let's try to build our models by assuming that people are acting rationally, that they have that they're acting in good faith, and then let's look at the problems they would encounter in a democratic system. And then the question is the way that political parties that are opposed to capitalism will behave under those conditions such that they will end up contributing to the stabilization rather than the disruption of capitalism, right? And thus resolve the puzzle. Marx's expectation was, you empower the hostile classes, this is really precarious for capital. What we observe is you empower the hostile classes, this is really stabilizing for capital. And Szymborski provides a way of understanding why Marx was wrong in those expectations. His predictions were wrong, as he predicted in the class struggles in France. The way Szymborski approaches this problem is by analyzing what he calls dilemmas. And these are three nested dilemmas. That is, each dilemma kicks in once you resolve a previous one. These are three nested dilemmas of democratic participation, of democratic politics. The idea of a dilemma, I think, is another one of these really interesting and important words and ideas to build into your social theory. So whatever you're studying, it's really helpful to think of actors. Let me step back a little bit. If you're studying a problem in which the strategic action of actors matters, that is, you believe human beings are individually agents, they make choices and act in the world, and they do so often collectively, so you have collective actors, a really useful way of thinking about the context of action is to see it as filled with dilemmas. Dilemmas are situations in which, to make it simple, you have two choices, and in the harshest of dilemmas, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. That is, each choice has serious negative ramifications, but you have to make a choice. There's no default. So the damned if you do and damned if you don't dilemma, that's the kind of harshest. Mostly it's just that there are trade-offs, that there are good reasons for both sides and there are costs to both sides. And it's often extremely hard to weigh the costs and benefits. And so you have a dilemma. You can't have your cake and eat it too, right? That's another... The fact that there's so many folk expressions that capture this shows that it's a reality of life. You can't have your cake and eat it too. You're damned if you do and damned if you don't. These are dilemmas. Well, think of strategic context as filled with dilemmas. One way, in fact, I guess this may not come up in this discussion. One way that I like to think of a notion of a hegemonic class is a class that's able to displace dilemmas onto its challengers rather than face them itself. So that's the ability to impose dilemmas on others is a real sign of your power. You can put damned if you do, damned if you don't choices on your competitors, then you're in a very powerful position. All right, three dilemmas. These can be called the participation dilemma, the alliances dilemma, and the anti-capitalism dilemma. So the first dilemma. We're the central committee of the Workers' Party. We're deciding what we want to do. Comrades, we have this choice. We can either contest elections, we can field candidates, we can organize electoral campaigns, or we can abstain from electoral politics, from bourgeois politics. We know that it's a trap, that if we engage in bourgeois politics and compete with these powerful bourgeois parties, they define the terrain of debate. We're going to be forced to be respectable. We're going to have to produce party programs as to what we'll do if we get elected. We're going to have to play by the rules of this game, and it's a trap. So you have some people in the party saying, no, let's remain an extra parliamentary party, mobilizing workers for direct action of various sorts. We'll cause trouble in the streets. We'll occupy Wall Street. We'll do all sorts of political actions that will raise issues and cause trouble, but we're not going to contest for elections, because to do so is to buy into the system. That's one comrade says this, and the other one says, listen, we got to be realistic. If we don't participate in these elections, however fraught with danger they are, we're just going to be marginalized, because other parties are going to enter these elections, and they're going to be trying to mobilize the same people that we want to mobilize. And we'd just be in a competitive disadvantage in our ideological work and our, you know, selling our party newspapers and all the other things we do if we're not on the ground contesting for elections. So you get this debate back and forth. And it's clear that there's a dilemma. The dilemma is that the democratic process actually does allow for the redress of some grievances. If you win elections, you can do things. The pursuit of electoral competition, therefore, enables parties who are successful to actually deliver the goods on some questions. And for most people, when faced with the choice of whether they're going to support a political movement that's going to provide some benefits versus one that's simply talking about long-term transformation but can't do anything in the short run because they refuse to participate at all in the system, the parties that participate will be more attractive. If the party opts for keeping out of elections, it risks being marginalized. If it opts for participating in elections, it risks being co-opted, being integrated into the system, affirming the legitimacy of the system by its very participation. Well, in the history of socialist politics, parties have done both things. Some have opted in, some have opted out. The ones that have opted out in stable democratic systems have always ended up being marginal. They never sustain themselves over time. Those that opt in sometimes do sustain themselves over time and become important actors in the political system. That's the first dilemma. Okay, we're now 10 years later. We're still the Central Committee. We're a little worse for wear. We've been fighting in these elections, and we're getting 4 or 5% of the vote in each election. We're getting pretty discouraged. We're trying to diagnose the problem. Why are we not doing better? And we've read our Shavorsky, and we hit the second dilemma. The second dilemma is the class alliance dilemma. Here's the problem. Now, this second problem raises all sorts of sociological questions about how to define the class structure, who's really a worker, is the working class 80% of the population or 30% of the population. Obviously, this depends upon how you define the working class in a formal sense. If workers are all people who work for a wage or salary, the working class in the labor force in the United States is in the 80 to 85% range. Some ambiguities because of the problem of defining self-employment, but roughly 80 to 85%. If you define workers as subordinated labor within employment relations who sell their labor power but have no rights to their jobs and et cetera, if you take this more restricted kind of notion, then the working class in the United States is probably in the 35 to 40% range, somewhere in that vicinity, with lots of contradictory locations of the sort that I've described. Shavorsky takes a fairly traditional Marxian idea of the working class as being manual labor, that is basically labor that is selling its labor power but doesn't have credentials to give it special rents in the market. It's basically manual labor. He fudges a little bit as to whether the kind of manual segment of white-collar labor is also working class or not. His argument doesn't really hinge on these details. So for them, I think we can take a soft focus on that part of the argument. The interesting part of the argument is this. The electoral game is a game of numbers where you need 51% to win. You have to get a majority to win. Realistically, if you want to win and institute a radical program, you need more than 51%. You really need 60, 65, 70%. You know, you need a supermajority to be able to push through a comprehensive social reconstruction project. You need a big majority to do so stably. The working class is never 65, 70% of the population. And even if it was, you'd have to get 100% of workers in order to win elections only by getting working class votes. So to win elections, you face this choice. Do we only appeal to the interests of workers? Do we fight as a working class party exclusively for the interests of workers? Or do we dilute our class ideology and appeal to a broader spectrum of voters? Do we try to maximize our vote in the election or maximize our working class vote in the election? Do we want to be a party in which we try to have our electorate be as dominated by the working class as possible, our constituency? Or do we want to be a party that attracts as many votes as possible? So he argues for there being these two ideal type strategies, a vote maximizing strategy and a class purity maximizing strategy. These two strategies create what can be called, what I like to call the Gramsci bounds on the vote. The upper bound is the maximum vote a socialist party could obtain by consistently pursuing the vote maximizing strategy, given the constraints it faces. And the minimum bound is the vote that it would be obtained by pursuing a strategy which attempts to maximize the purity of its class base at every time. And the class base strategy is always below the vote maximizing strategy. Right? Now, what changes over time are two things. The class structure changes over time. So in the course of the history of capitalism, the working class becomes larger. The larger the working class is, the higher the minimum boundary would be. But also what changes over time is the history of voting. You know, what changes over time is people get recruited to parties, people abandon parties, and people become loyal to parties. So a key parameter in Shavorsky's model is the loyalty of voters to a party once they're voting for the party. His essential argument about this dilemma is that working class voters who are voting for the Socialist Party will do so with a certain stickiness, even if the party changes its policy. So it's not the case that if a party that had for a certain period of time been a class purity party shifts to a vote maximizing party, that suddenly workers start abandoning the party. What happens is that on the margin, the capacity to recruit new working class voters declines relative to the capacity to attract non-working class voters. So you reduce your capacity to recruit workers relative to non-workers as you shift from a working class party to a vote maximizing party. And so that over time your vote gets diluted. What Shavorsky observes empirically is that all socialist parties after a certain point shift to vote maximizing strategies. They get tired of being perpetually minority parties. They actually want to contest to win elections, not just play elections. That their inability to win elections ultimately erodes their base they begin to, because they it becomes harder to recruit any voters if you never have a prospect of winning. And therefore, they adopt vote-maximizing strategies. His formal models enable him to do some pretty nifty things. I mean, if you're interested, if any of you have interest in mathematical modeling, you should read the larger book, Paper Stones, of which the chapter in Capitalism and Social Democracy is derived. He does some, you can do some pretty cool things. You can, for example, take the upper and bottom limits, you know, these structurally defined limits of Sweden and the strategies of the socialist parties in Germany in the 1920s to 1930s, or vice versa. You can take the strategies of the Swedish party and put it into Germany with the German constraints and ask the question, what would have been the fate of the German social democrats if they had adopted the Swedish strategy? So you can model what their vote trajectories would look like. When he does his models, and within countries, that is, you look at, he estimates the upper and lower bounds for Sweden, and then just looks at the vote for the socialists in Sweden, they do fall within these bounds. So the model is pretty good in reproducing the upper and lower bounds of the actual behavior of the party. And then you can do these counterfactuals to see if it would have made any difference. I believe his argument for the German case is that the actual bounds became very narrow in Germany, that strategy mattered less and less over time, because the upper and lower bound began to converge for various reasons, which he explains. Well, that's the second dilemma. And what's happened is that all of the parties shift their strategy over time. They become vote-maximizing strategy, and then eventually some of them win. Once they become, but by virtue of becoming vote-maximizing strategy, they lose their revolutionary edge. They cease to be, in order to be a vote-maximizing party, they can't be this insistent attacker of capitalism at its foundations. They have to moderate their political message in order to become a party of class alliances. Sometimes they can do so in ways that keep the core values of socialism at the center, values of solidarity and equality and participation. And sometimes those values begin to be marginalized as well. That depends upon the ideological and historical context in which this strategy shift occurs. Now, I should note that there is a there's people who are critical of this second dilemma. They say it's not really a dilemma. There's a very nice master's thesis done in this department by Rui Teixeira, who is now a very famous political pollster for the Democratic Party. This was done in the early 80s. He did a study of the Socialist Party in Milwaukee, which in the 1890s was getting 4 or 5% of the vote. And then by 1914 won the, or 1916 won the mayor's election. And then there was a socialist mayor in Milwaukee for a couple of decades. And it had the city council as well at one point. So there was one election where there was a socialist city council and a socialist mayor. So the question that he asked was, it clearly shifted its strategy to a vote-maximizing strategy. What did this do to its class base? And what Teixeira found is that the working class base increased when it went to a vote-maximizing strategy. That it became a more purely working class party, not a less purely working class party. It just was much more able to mobilize workers when workers were being appealed to on the basis of good government, clean government, what came to be called sewer socialism, meaning not a socialism in the gutters, but a socialism of the gutters, or about gutters, that is, providing clean water and clean sewers. The Socialist Party ran on civic improvement grounds, and was very successful among workers. But it didn't attract very many middle-class voters anyway, because the middle-class voters didn't believe it. They thought these were socialist radicals and that they were going to engage in all sorts of socialist policies anyway. So Teixeira's argument was a kind of critique of Szaborski on the grounds that appealing to non-class-based interests, that is, general civic improvement goals, made it a much more appealing party for workers. Finally, the third dilemma is the dilemma, what do you do if you actually win elections? So you get into power, you can do what you want. Well, that's the transition trough problem that we've already discussed. The third dilemma is that once you're in power, the first thing you try to do is to improve employment, to stabilize the economy, to do all the things that actually in the immediate run make life better for people. And a lot of that has to do with stabilizing the conditions for good accumulation. So socialist parties universally, when they're in power, actually strengthen capitalism. It turns out that they're often able to do so better than conservative parties. And that's because they get much higher levels of cooperation by workers. Workers will go along. They'll trust that they will reap the benefits of an improved capitalism. And therefore, they go along with this. And that actually allows the reforms to take place that are good for capitalism, but with spillover effects that are also good for workers. And that's the nesting of these three dilemmas is why democratic capitalism turns out to be very stable capitalism. And now we are ready for ideology next week. We are back on schedule. All right. Just one thing. On the third paper, as I've said, when you've written your paper, give them to me rather than wait till the very end. It will certainly be helpful to me to be able to read these over a 10-day period. The due date, the final due date is the 14th, because we are going to have two classes that last week of classes. I am leaving the country that Saturday, so it'll be tough for me to read all the papers before I leave if they are mostly handed in on the 14th. So any of you doing papers on topics that you feel comfortable writing on before then, I'd appreciate getting even some next week, if possible. Okay.